Each week, By Design looks at ideas in the design and architecture world. And this week, we're thinking about Asia and China in particular. Where once we looked to Europe for the design of our houses, our clothing, towns and cities, how is our relationship with China changing all that? And is this making us more Asian in our outlook? In the last decade in particular, many Australians have made their way to China, and these include architects and designers, some working on high-end projects like the Water Cube, as the swimming centre at the Beijing Olympic, designed by the Australian firm PTW Architects. And there are many, many other Australian-designed buildings across China. So today, we look at how the ideas coming out of China, the way China looks, from the apartment blocks to the new cities and towns, is ever so gently changing our design and cultural world in Australia. Joining me today are three guests who, I must say, move easily between these two seemingly different countries. Joining me, of course, from the ABC Beijing studios is writer Jessica Rudd. Hello, Jessica. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. Also with me in the studio is the recently retired director of the Art Gallery of New South Wales, Edmund Capon. Hello, Edmund.
Hello, Fernando.
Welcome. And also architect Dylan Brady from Studio 505. Welcome to you too, Dylan.
Thank you very much.
Good to have you all here. Now, before we get into the discussion in full, Dylan, I would very much like to hear firstly from you about working in China and why Australian architects are doing so well. I know you're based in Melbourne, but you travel back and forth between China and Australia. How would you describe the opportunities for Australian architects in China?
I think that China is a fantastic opportunity, not just to necessarily go there to win a project as an architect, but to actually experience how a vastly different scale of culture goes about its architecture. A lot of the projects that I've worked on here in Australia before I had my own practice were large public buildings, and that's where I met my fellow director, and we've always had as a practice a very international kind of mindset, given that he's from Germany and I've travelled quite a lot. Our connection into China has been one where through the development of projects like Federation Square that gave us an extremely bold position, China has been the ultimate kind of playground for that, where there's a real enthusiasm for character and difference and extraordinariness to be delivered in many of their key projects.
That's a really great way of putting it, because these sorts of buildings that you're doing in China, you don't really get those sorts of opportunities here in Australia, do you? I mean, hockey stadiums with hotels attached, youth palaces, quite, you know, grand designs and things like that.
Yeah, there is this fascinating thing that happens with briefs in China where they sort of take two completely disparate elements like a science and cultural arts centre and an opera house and IMAX theatre and sort of smash the two things together and go, it's going to be this new kind of thing, which strangely works. That was the first project that we were invited to look at in China through a relationship in Singapore was a facade for a very, very large project in Suzhou. And it was kind of set the tone for the way that we did the rest of our work in China, where we were really competing in an aesthetic imaginary space. Anything can be made, so what should it be? And we were able, as a very small practice then, to come up with some really free thinking that I think is something that China is still learning how to do internally, is a lot of that kind of free thinking and design-driven confidence that lets you break boundaries without, you know, breaking rules.
So it's a pretty amazing opportunity for you and for other Australian architects and architectural firms. For you, though, it all started with quite a small project, didn't it? A facade. How did that begin?
Well, the facade was 22,000 square metres and was the biggest job that we'd ever done. The job that we did before that was significantly smaller. That project came about through relationships, through good relationships. We and Dirk and myself have long known that it's not what necessarily you know, but who you know. You obviously have to be able to deliver. But through our work in Singapore and Federation Square, we were often in discussions with Singaporean companies. Those companies had made inroads into China at the very sort of first opening of the architectural industry there. And we were invited in by that project management company because they could see that the local design institute hadn't perhaps met the expectation of the client in the delivery or the conception of a particular facade. And we had a bit of expertise in that, Dirk and I, following Federation Square. And, you know, like bulls to the carrot, we were off.
Can you tell me a bit more about how you actually get these projects? You say it's who you know, but is it just that? Is it word of mouth? How does the design business work then?
Oh, well, look, I think that the ultimate challenge for any design business is getting runs on the board and being given an opportunity to show what you can do. For us, it's been a very interesting kind of stepping stone process whereby some of the larger kind of more full contracts we've received from overseas, which has let us then come back to Australia and go, yes, well, we've done these large projects already, but there aren't that many, you know, sort of 65,000 square metre cultural centres being built in Melbourne that you can kind of compete on and win as a small practice against other larger, more established practices. So an architectural practice in China from Australia can't actually deliver the final construction documentation. You always have to have a local design institute that you work with. What that means is that the deliverables of your work are very much sit at the front end. And we've got a great capacity in Australia, in particular in the sort of the design industry, to be able to innovate and think fresh ideas and think freely about stuff. But with a bit of background knowledge on having delivered a few projects here, we're able to actually conceive of realizable buildings at the front end that then a great sweeping team of Chinese architects will come in and actually do the construction documentation for. So you only need know how to conceive of and communicate an idea in order to have an opportunity.
You go to China quite a lot, though, don't you, Dylan? So does it feel a bit like home now for you?
It's incredibly familiar, the parts of it that I've been to, but because, I mean, I'm in China about once a month. We should catch up, Edmund, Jessica, sometime when I'm there.
That'd be great.
Thanks for inviting me, Dylan.
Oh, well, if you're there, welcome to come by. I mainly fly into Shanghai, either through Guangzhou or Singapore or Hong Kong. I'm then on my way to Changzhou, which is where our representative office is and where one of our kind of main kind of clusters of projects and fabulous kind of relationships with governments exist at the moment. We've been asked to do some extraordinary buildings which are being built, and I show people pictures of this Lotus project that we're doing and they go, yeah, whatever. And then I show them a photograph of the thing under construction and they're like, oh, my God.
That's pretty magical. Well, you're on By Design here on RN and we're talking about our relationship with China. I'm joined by architect Dylan Brady, also Edmund Capon from the Art Gallery of New South Wales, very recently retired director, and also writer Jessica Rudd, all sharing a great love of China, and this is a good opportunity to bring you all in. Now, Jessica, I might start with you because you live in Beijing. Can you tell me a little bit about that experience for you? I just asked Dylan the question, is China now a part of you?
Absolutely, but I think China has always been a part of me. For me, I was here as a baby. My dad was a diplomat here in the early 80s. And so I was 12 days old when we moved to Hong Kong and 6 months old when we moved to Beijing. So my mum and I, rather than sit in a diplomatic residence compound, we decided, she decided, I didn't have much say in it, to go exploring the streets of Beijing. And mum spent a lot of time just picking up beautiful things from all around the city. So we would go to pig farms and junkyards and find amazing vases and rugs and incredible teapots and things like that. So I grew up surrounded by these beautiful objects and just thought that that was a normal part of being an Australian kid. Mm. Now, fast forward 28 years and here I am again, and I've been here now for 2.5 years. I love it. I absolutely love this city. I love its vibrance. I love how alive it is, and I'm really looking forward to having my own little one here so we can go exploring.
Edmund, do you feel an affinity with what Jessica's saying? Obviously, she talks about beautiful objects, but you've been travelling to China for a very, very long time now.
Absolutely, I do, and I first went there in 1972.
Wow.
That's a whole different journey.
I went with a little bunch of loony lefties and Maoists from London.
The old trots.
Yeah, the old trots, and there were eight of us, and we went to Shanghai because that was the only airport, Pakistan Airlines. I think we were the only eight people on the plane, and I think there was one light bulb in Shanghai then. It was hugely different, but Beijing is the place I love. Beijing is one of those cities that's redolent with the echo of history and authority. It's got, and the architecture, of course, of the Forbidden City is replete with that kind of order and hierarchy. And I think that's one of the wonderful things. I know the first time I went into that, of course, it was completely and totally empty. And it's an experience I will never, ever forget. And I love walking around Beijing. I have long walks that I regularly take from this place to the Yunhe Gong, to the Confucius Temple, and all around. I think it's a great, great city.
It is a great city. I've actually been to Beijing a couple of times myself, but a few years ago, and I wonder if you could all weigh in here, and particularly you, Dylan. My memories of Beijing is that it's a city of construction. From 1972, Edmund, things must have changed dramatically. Dylan, how has it changed?
Oh, look, I mean, I was 1 year old in 1972. It's changed a lot since then. But
Your memory is my memory.
No, I find there's an immensity to Beijing that is truly fascinating, and there's also a duality to Beijing that I really love when I go there. The old Hutong cities and lanes and the kind of human scale of that, which we must all stand up and make sure is not destroyed.
Absolutely.
Incredible. Yes. It is incredible. It is a model for living in a city. Mm. Yeah. And it seems somehow ironic and a little maddening to be invited to China to design new cities when I want to actually point at their old ones and say, them like this.
And this is a great source of frustration for me too. I wander around all of the old laneways of the Hutongs, and I watch the old guys playing checkers on the corner, and I watch the ladies gossiping and talking about
taking their birds for a walk.
Yeah. Taking their birds for a walk in cages. And I mean, there's a great beauty of community here, and I think that for a giant sprawling city with the population of Australia, or perhaps even more than that if you don't believe the official estimates, I think that it's amazing that you can find that kind of community in a city this big. Mm.
It's a brilliant model, and it's a model in line with the kind of the topic of the conversation.
And it's all happened so very quickly too.
It has happened very quickly.
Because when in 1972, the old Beijing Hotel was the tallest building, and it was surrounded by cabbage-strewn hutongs. And then you go now and see what's happened with that sort of frenetic burst of energy and building. And, of course, buildings, they're very virile things in the kind of the psyche of a nation. And great tall buildings, like the latest CCTV building, which is like a kind of sort of slightly starched pair of trousers. It's the most peculiar building imaginable.
Folded over.
Yes.
What about in comparison to construction here? If there's so much construction there and such risk-taking as well, Dylan, do we shape up, do you think?
Fenella, I could fit Melbourne into one of the blocks of Beijing, and I have the lucky opportunity to travel a lot around China, into the centre, down south, up north. I try and do as much of possible as that on these fabulous trains that they have, and it's a little bit strange trying to put into your mind that you're leaving a place and going through a nothing and then coming to another place, because it just never finishes. There's always buildings and structures and stuff. The difference between Suzhou and Wuxi is a line on a map. There is no end to the city in there.
There's no whoop-whoop. There's no whoop-whoop
yeah,
here.
Yeah, there's... You,
it doesn't
and
exist
I come back to Australia regularly. I often joke I've been to China more times than many of my Chinese employees. And I come back to Australia and I can get into my car and drive, and 40 minutes later I'm surrounded by paddocks and cows on a two-way, single-lane kind of piece of bitumen called the Hume Highway. Mm. And I'm struck at the idea that Australia is actually a second-world country with a couple of first-world cities in it, because the sheer scale and infrastructural capacity of China is astounding.
It's pretty remarkable. Jessica, could I get you to talk a little bit about living there, though? If we're talking about the loss of perhaps of hutongs and the changing nature of the streets and the infrastructure in China, you live in an apartment block in the centre of Beijing. You grew up in Brisbane. What? Tell me a bit about vertical life and how do you reconcile that?
Well, I had this wonderful fantasy when I first moved to Beijing a couple of years ago with my husband that we would be able to live in a hutong. And some of my friends do, but they say they're very, very cold winters because there are giant gaps underneath the doors.
Get tough, Jessica. Come on.
I know. I need to harden up. But so we did originally move into a high-rise apartment building around Jianguomenne, which is quite central. It was in the middle of a series of hutongs. And it was lovely because we had that sense of community, but we also had all of the mod cons. Then we moved into a more international building block, and that's because I'm about to have a baby, and, you know, the convenience of life in that kind of a community is... It really suits people like me and my husband. But, you know, I really wish I could have that romantic life of living perhaps on Hohai, which is a lake in Beijing, and in a beautiful hutong, and, you know, looking out into my courtyard with my lovely persimmon tree.
You just got to get a summer residence, Jessica.
Yeah, you need your own summer
palace.
Up
in the fragrant hills. Yeah. Yeah.
In other words, I need to stop being an author and start making some money.
But the life of living in an apartment block, and I know that you, for example, write in a cafe that, I mean, our cafes in our cities are generally on ground floors. You write on the 27th floor or something like that. I'm just curious, Jessica, perhaps Edmund, if you could weigh in here as well, if there's something that we could take as an example of that, the existence of living vertically in China and in the cities is quite common. What is that like in some ways?
I couldn't imagine living on the 27th floor of anything. I want to walk out onto the earth, not into... And I just... I think for me to have that permanent sort of panoramic view of things would, I find, most disconcerting. I like to be out, to walk straight out onto a street. And the idea of actually working up in the sky, to me, is a complete anathema. I could not do it. And it's like that in... Yeah, if you stay in a hotel, sometimes you have right up there, it's fine. You do it for a day, a night or two. But I couldn't live there at all. And particularly in a place like Beijing, which to me is one of the great walking cities. I'm sure Jessica used to ride bikes everywhere. I used to ride bikes around Beijing, but that's a bit lethal these days, to say the least.
It is a bit lethal. You're listening to By Design on Radio National. I'm joined in our panel conversation today by writer Jessica Rudd, Edmund Capon, and architect Dylan Brady. And we would love to hear what you think. How is our relationship with China changing the design of our lives, our houses, clothing, towns and cities? You can join the conversation on Facebook or on our website. So can we talk a bit about that, Edmund, Jessica and Dylan, about design? Are we less European? Are we more Asian in our design aesthetic and influences? What's changed? Dylan, can I start with you?
Oh, it's a very difficult question. I think that there's an extraordinary globality to the way that that the top designers are thinking about the world at the moment. That ideas are only, you know, half an hour away around the world, and to bring an Australian style to China, I think, would be a bit disingenuous. We've very much had the good fortune and luck to be working on projects that are extremely fast and require a great clarity about the story that you're going to tell. And we're quite often taken to places and our brief is simply make it beautiful or here it is, and we're walking around 15 square kilometres of what's very blatantly, obviously, nothing, a sort of reclaimed wasteland almost, and they say, we want this place to be full of character. And my immediate demand is, you know, for a mountain here and a river there and this kind of geological stuff that you can't actually, I mean, if you needed to order a mountain, China's probably the only place you could.
You could actually do it. but Jessica, what about for you? Do you think that we could learn from China in terms of our aesthetic and our design?
I think when it comes to community, I think we have a lot to learn from China. I think that we can live in big cities and feel like we know our neighbours. That is one thing that is nice about living in a high-rise kind of building, because you've got to understand that your ceiling is someone else's floor. Yeah, exactly. And so you know that when the toddler upstairs, you know when the toddler upstairs has had a massive two-year-old tantrum and just completely spat the dummy. And you know that if you've had a big party the night before, you've really got to apologise to the people downstairs for all the stomping. And we also have a lot to learn from the Hutong way of living I was talking about before. I just really admire the way that in this city there are people who take the time to fly kites. You know, there are people who stop, and there's a place that I go to all the time. It's an old place in Beijing. It's Ruotan Park. It's kind of Beijing's answer to Central Park. And there's a small pagoda in the highest part of the park where old guys gather.
The
Temple of the Sun, hey?
Yeah. And it, exactly. And they sit there and they sip tea, and it's out of a thermos, and they fly their kites.
It's a really beautiful community, of course, that we can definitely learn from. By Design on Radio National, I'm afraid, Edmund, I'm going to have to wrap it up here, though, just to be sad here. But I wanted to just finish up, because this might actually be a good opportunity here to talk about what we've been talking about at the end of our panels each week, which is our favourite design object. And Edmund, would you mind telling us what your favourite design object is?
My favourite design object?
Yes. Your favourite object.
I would be very simple. It would be something, this is for so Chinese, it is something that was found completely by accident. A Buddha, a stone Buddha, carved in the 6th century, discovered while they were digging up a playing field, and it is so modern that people would look at it and think it was made by Brancusi.
Absolutely beautiful. And Jessica, for you, your favourite object, very quickly?
I like my doona a lot.
Me too. I love your doona. And Dylan, what is your favourite design object?
Well, my favourite object of design and that I design with is the pen.
I'm holding one right now. An absolute pleasure to have each of you joining us on By Design, and a big thank you to architect Dylan Brady, the former director of the Art Gallery of New South Wales, Edmund Capon, and writer Jessica Rudd. Thank you for your time and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And don't forget, this conversation will continue. We would love to hear your stories as well. You can email us or say hi on our new Facebook page. And there are links to everyone on our new website, abc.net.au/rn/bydesign.